From the studios of the Mayo Clinic News Network, this is Mayo Clinic Radio, exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you.
Welcome, everyone, to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, arthritis affects more than one in four adults in the U.S., and it's a common cause of chronic pain.
On today's program, we'll discuss arthritis and ways to manage and improve symptoms with a Mayo Clinic expert.
You can grow new cartilage. You can grow new bone. The problem is, so far, that we haven't really figured out in the average person how to get it into the joint so that it will stay, so that it will stick and not deteriorate after the patient starts using that joint again.
Also on the program, we'll hear about the latest in liver cancer treatment.
And how behavioral interventions can help treat insomnia.
All that along with this week's health and medical news right after this. Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
Arthritis is one of the leading causes of disability in the United States, and it's extremely common. In fact, one in four people over the age of 18 have doctor-diagnosed arthritis, meaning that they've been to the doctor and they've actually been diagnosed with arthritis. There's probably a lot more people that have arthritis that don't know about it or haven't been to the doctor. And it's estimated that the economic burden of arthritis is close to $130 billion every year in the United States. Arthritis, of course, is inflammation of one or more of your joints. The main symptoms of arthritis, well, everybody knows, it's joint pain and stiffness. And it tends to get gradually worse over time, gradually worse as you get older.
The two most common types of arthritis are osteoarthritis, also known as wear and tear arthritis, and rheumatoid arthritis. And here to discuss arthritis and its impact on individuals and society is Mayo Clinic rheumatologist Dr. Eric Madison. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Madison. It's nice to see you again.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Good to have you here. Arthritis, an extremely common problem, and it affects and costs this country a lot of money.
That's for sure. In fact, new estimates of arthritis prevalence show us that more than 90 million people in this country have arthritis. And the newest studies show us that a surprising number of people under the age of 65 have arthritis, probably more than 35% of people over the age of 18, between 18 and 65, have arthritis. And so this is an enormous number of people. And the disability that's associated with that, the healthcare costs that are associated with that, and the personal costs of the patients because of how arthritis affects us in our hobbies and in our jobs, our daily lives, is enormous.
So I actually underestimated the number of people who have arthritis more than most people even think.
Yes.
And just like any other time when we have interviewed you, as soon as we start talking about it, I start kind of checking, how are my fingers feeling? And I think, well, they kind of ache a little bit. Is that arthritis? Is pain arthritis? What do you consider arthritis to be?
Well, arthritis does cause pain, and it causes dysfunction in the joints. So when we think about arthritis, what we're thinking about, like Dr. Shives mentioned, we're thinking about inflammation and damage that's occurring in the joints. So not every joint pain, not every muscle pain that we have is arthritis, but the persistence of pain in the joints, especially when it's more than 6 weeks, 8 weeks, 12 weeks, and longer, probably does represent arthritis to some extent.
And what causes it?
Well, there are lots of causes of arthritis. In fact, there are more than 200 forms of arthritis. Some forms of arthritis are caused by deterioration as we get older. Sometimes we have genes that are a little weak that make our cartilage, so our cartilage deteriorates faster, and that causes arthritis. Trauma causes arthritis. Some jobs that people do, for example, we know that people that spend a lot of time, for example, laying floors and carpets have a lot more arthritis in their knees. Arthritis that's caused by metabolic disturbances like gout, for example. And then there are all of the autoimmune diseases, such as rheumatoid arthritis that you mentioned, which also can cause arthritis.
So let's tell our audience, what's really happening here is that the cartilage is damaged. The cartilage is being destroyed. And that's the glistening white layer over the end of bones. If you open up a chicken bone and you look on the end of the bone, there's glistening white tissue, that's the cartilage. And as arthritis means that that cartilage has worn out, but in fact, cartilage doesn't have a blood supply, doesn't have a nerve supply. It's nourished by the joint fluid. So the pain is really not caused from the cartilage degeneration. It's caused by the associated inflammation, correct?
Right. The associated inflammation and the effect of the cartilage damage on the underlying bone. So there's the cartilage, as you said, lays right over the bone. And when the cartilage deteriorates, the bone also deteriorates and breaks down.
And the bone's got a blood supply.
And the guy's a nerve supply. And nerves, yes. So that's
but
why
isn't
we have
that interesting that the cartilage doesn't have a blood supply nourished by the joint fluid?
Right. Mm-hmm.
So we don't really have an idea why this all happens and why it's so common. And it's not a new disease. People have had arthritis forever, right?
They have had arthritis forever, although it does seem to be more common today than it has been in the past, and we're not exactly sure why that is. One of the speculative reasons is because we simply are bigger in our society today than in the past. We have more weight. Our bodies are larger. We carry more weight. There's more people who are obese, overweight, than in the past, and there's a direct relationship between being overweight and developing arthritis. So I think that's one of the reasons why we are, in fact, seeing more arthritis today than we have in the past.
We've gotten too big.
Well, that's then the first risk factor for developing arthritis?
That's a major risk factor for developing wear and tear arthritis.
What are some others?
Well, we know that smoking, interestingly, is associated with developing arthritis, although we don't know exactly why that is. It's more commonly associated with rheumatoid arthritis because smoking actually triggers the immune system to become more active in a way that we are exploring here at Mayo Clinic, but we're not exactly sure how this happens. But we know that it is a fact, and we know that smoking can induce the development of certain proteins that are immunologically active in our immune system that eventually go on to attack the joints and destroy the joints.
You know, in the introduction, we said that arthritis is the leading cause of disability in the United States. But when you compare that to back pain and headache, is it really number one?
I think that it is number one. In fact, if we think about some causes of headache, are deterioration of the bones and cartilage in our cervical spine, in the spine of our neck. And when we even talk about back pain, we're often talking about arthritis, in fact, with deterioration of the discs, which are cartilage also, and the bones of the vertebrae of our spine. So even there, arthritis plays a major role in causing those back pain symptoms.
People probably don't think about arthritis in their back. They think about their knees or their hands, their fingers, but arthritis in the back is very common or not common?
Very common.
Yeah, so there are little joints that have cartilage on them between all the vertebrae, and they're called facet joints. Mm-hmm. And just like any other joint in your body, those can wear out.
Boy, you are so smart. I had no idea.
So you talked about, let's go back to the risk factors again. Obesity was one. Family history is another, isn't
it? Family history is very important. There are definitely genetic predispositions to almost every kind of arthritis. And we know of families where there are inherited weaknesses of cartilage genes, so that the genes that are responsible for making cartilage don't make strong cartilage, and those families are predisposed to developing arthritis, for example.
Anything else? So obesity, family history, smoking.
Smoking. I think those are some of the...
Those are the big ones?
Those are the big ones, and trauma.
All right, let's talk about a minute about the economic impact. And is that because people are unable to work because of their arthritis, or does it also have to do with the cost for caring for these patients?
It's both of those things, of course. Time loss is a major reason for a loss of productivity in America, and it's one of the indirect, we say, costs of having arthritis that runs into the billions every year. And then, of course, there are the costs of taking care of the arthritis as well. So all of the medications that are necessary, the doctor visits that are necessary, and the surgeries that are necessary, as well as some of the other therapies, for example, physical therapy and rehabilitation, that's very important for management of arthritis. All of those things entail huge costs, and you mentioned that those costs are over $130 billion per year. That's easily the figure that's reached because of arthritis.
Amazing. All right, rheumatologist Dr. Eric Madison, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk about all the treatment options there are for people with arthritis. Plus, we've got a myth or matter of fact.
That's right, and this is always a popular question. Cracking your knuckles can cause arthritis. We'll find out. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
We are with rheumatologist Dr. Eric Madison talking about the impact of arthritis, how common it is. We've talked about the risk factors. We've talked about the economic impact. And now it's time for myth or matter of fact.
This little factoid is always so popular. So myth or matter of fact, cracking your knuckles can cause arthritis. Is that a myth or a fact, Dr. Madison?
Were our mothers right or not?
Regrettably, it's a myth. And I say regrettably because it is an annoying habit.
All right. Good to know.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about treatment options. We know there are a lot of people who have arthritis. We know that being obese, smoking, having a family history increases your risk for arthritis. But we also know you've got a lot of treatment options. So let's start with, I guess, medication.
For wear and tear arthritis, medications basically are used to help with the pain. We know that arthritis does cause a lot of pain, so medications such as acetaminophen or Tylenol or what we call nonsteroidals such as ibuprofen, Aleve, Motrin, Naprosyn, those kind of medications can help to relieve the pain, but they do not change the structure of the cartilage of the joints, unfortunately.
They don't change the course of the disease.
They do not.
Now, is it true that because we know and we've talked about the fact that it's the inflammation associated with the arthritic process that causes a significant amount of the pain?
Right.
Wouldn't it make sense that the NSAIDs, the nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory medications, work better than Tylenol? Acetaminophen, because acetaminophen is not anti-inflammatory, but the other ones are?
That is true. And so for many people, it is in fact the case that the NSAIDs work better for reducing pain. But if there's not a lot of inflammation involved, then Tylenol may work just as well. So it's something that each individual has to see for themselves what works the best for them.
What kind of therapy works for people with arthritis? Is there physical therapy that works?
There is physical therapy that helps. I think that the things that are most helpful are strengthening the muscles around the joints and physical activity. Actually, walking, swimming, biking are the things that help the most. If our muscles become weak, our joints take more of a beating. And so these activities are really important for managing arthritis.
So those activities that you talked about are non-impact activities. So, for example, an elliptical would be much better for you than a treadmill if you've got hip and knee arthritis.
Yes, I think so.
And swimming?
And
absolutely
swimming is
the best, huh?
Is a great exercise, right?
It doesn't help much for osteoporosis or osteopenia because you're not stressing your bones to keep them strong, but it's best for the arthritis.
I think so, too.
Alternative treatments. I want to ask you about those. Now, you know what? We better talk about surgery first, because everybody's had a total hip or a total knee, haven't they? Or they're in line for one.
Well, today, surgery is what's needed very frequently, and I think that more than 1 million people in this country every year undergo hip replacement surgery, and more than 1 million people undergo knee replacement surgery. So that tells us what a great impact the arthritis has. And unfortunately, that's where it comes down to sometimes for our patients.
You know, I've heard you say that I'm older than dirt, and that's close, but I just want you to know that.
I didn't know you heard that.
I worked with Dr. Mark Coventry when I was a resident here, and it had been about 3 or 4 years previously that he had done the first total hip in the United States. And he went over to England and learned the technique from Dr. John Charnley, who invented the total hip. And back in those, even in those days, we were doing total hip, total hip, total hip, and total knees. And things are better now. The surgery is better. The surgery is faster. It's easier. The prostheses are better than they used to be. But we've been doing these for a long time.
Is there any effect that, maybe this is the power of great advertising or it really does work, is there any effect of glucosamine chondroitin on joints?
Well, Dr. Shives mentioned that the cartilage doesn't have a blood supply. So when we think about how chondroitin might work or glucosamine might work, these are substances that are actually manufactured by cartilage cells. And the cartilage cell actually is only capable of using the glucosamine that it makes itself. It cannot take up the cartilage that we ingest, that we put in our mouths, that goes into our bloodstream. It simply does not get to our joints. Now, some people do get pain relief by taking glucosamine, but what we don't get is new cartilage.
One of the most important things that I know that people can do that we should probably emphasize in addition to activity and strengthening exercises is losing weight.
Yes. That is a major risk factor, like we pointed out already, and it is the major thing beyond the activity, the strengthening that an individual can do for themselves to reduce their arthritis risk, and even if they have arthritis, to slow down the progression of that arthritis.
To that point then, is there any dietary measures that people can take aside from losing weight?
There must be an arthritis diet that someone has touted.
Yes, there are many arthritis diets, and the most effective arthritis diet that there is calorie reduction. The exercise of pushing yourself away from the table 3 times a day is probably one of the most effective things that we can do to reduce our arthritis risk.
All right, what's new in research, and can you grow new cartilage?
You can grow new cartilage. You can grow new bone. The problem is, so far, that we haven't really figured out in the average person how to get it into the joint so that it will stay, so that it will stick and not deteriorate after it becomes, after the patient starts using that joint again. Preventing the breakdown of those newly implanted cells is a real problem still.
So you can grow them in the petri dish. You can grow them outside the body, but when you try to grow them inside the body, they just don't stay. Don't stick.
That's right. For most of us, that is the case. For very young people, it's a little bit different. They still have growing bone and cartilage, and sometimes you can fill in defects in younger people. But for most of us, it's still something that's in the future.
What else in research might people be interested in finding out?
Well, there's a lot of things that are happening with 3D printing and making new what we call matrices that are put into the joint and having cartilage and bone cells grow around these matrices. That's something that's quite exciting that's coming along. And in the field of inflammatory arthritis, such as rheumatoid arthritis and autoimmune diseases, we have a whole host of medications that are very effective in reducing the inflammatory disease, in reducing the joint damage, and improving the quality of life of people who have rheumatic arthritis, rheumatoid arthritis, psoriatic arthritis, and related forms of arthritis.
Yep, and until you get that all figured out, their best options are medications, surgery, last resort, but it works really
well. It works really well.
And therapy.
Yes.
All right, Dr. Eric Madison, talking about the impact of arthritis, a common problem in the United States. Thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome. It's very nice to be here. Thank you.
Still to come on Mayo Clinic Radio, we'll have an update on the latest in treatment for liver cancer.
And later on in the show, how behavioral interventions can help treat insomnia.
Coming up, the latest health and medical news with Vivian Williams. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams with your Mayo Clinic Minute. Are you looking for ways to burn calories without burning out on exercise? To lose 1 pound of fat per week, burn 500 calories per day more than you consume. Knowing the numbers can make it tempting to try to burn too many calories too quickly. Now, a 160-pound person walking briskly for an hour can burn as many as 277 calories, and running for an hour is 986 calories. But here's the rub about the burn from Dr. Michael Jensen.
I just had too many patients who tried too hard to start with. They became discouraged. They got injured.
Dr. Jensen says if you're trying to shed pounds, start by cutting extra unnecessary calories from your diet.
Having an immediate change in eating habits and then gradually increasing your physical activity until you have a comfortable active lifestyle is probably the best combination.
Step one is eat a little less. Step two is start a slow burn. Instead of that brisk hour-long walk, even walking at a 2 mile per hour pace, you could burn 183 calories an hour.
Build up your endurance, build up your strength, and then you can add more as time goes on.
In this case, slow and steady can win that race. For the Mayo Clinic News Network, I'm Vivian Williams.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
Cancer of the liver, it can be either primary or secondary. That is, it either starts in the liver, primary liver cancer, or it spreads there from someplace else. Some other cancer in the body spreads to or metastasizes to the liver. Now, the most common primary cancer of the liver is called hepatocellular carcinoma, or HCC.
The liver?
The liver, just beneath your diaphragm,
all
above
right.
your stomach, about the size of a football.
I've
well, yours
heard.
Is the size of a small
I've
football.
I've never seen one, but I've heard.
Well, the liver is sort of the refinery of your body. It filters the blood, it detoxifies chemicals, it metabolizes drugs, and it secretes bile that aids in your digestion. It's been said, really, that the liver lets you live.
Hepatocellular. Hepatocellular carcinoma. It occurs most often in people with chronic liver diseases such as cirrhosis caused by hepatitis B or hepatitis C infection. Until recently, there was only one FDA-approved drug for the treatment of HCC. But in 2017, a second drug was approved, and more treatment options may be just around the corner. Here to discuss liver cancer and new treatment options is Dr. Steve Elberts. Dr. Elberts is Division Chair of Medical Oncology at Mayo Clinic in Minnesota.
Great to see you. Nice to have you on the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, I think, if I'm right about this, liver cancer is relatively rare. It doesn't even make the top 10 of cancers that affect people in the United States, correct?
In the United States, that's correct. It's rare as cancers go, but around the world, it's one of the most common cancers.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And why is that?
Mainly because of things like hepatitis C or hepatitis B that are much more common in Asia, certain parts of Africa, as well as some other risk factors. In Africa, traditionally, there have been some contaminants of food, particularly peanuts, where you can have a mold that grows in there that creates a toxin called aflatoxin that leads to liver cancer. So between hepatitis and certain toxins in the environment or with foods, that has led to a high rate of liver cancer.
So where you live is actually one of the risk factors.
It is, absolutely.
Other risk factors? We mentioned them briefly. Hepatitis,
sure.
Some kind of liver disease, cirrhosis.
Right. Anything that can cause damage to the liver, whether it's viruses like hepatitis B or hepatitis C, as well as alcohol traditionally that creates problems with liver damage leading to cirrhosis. And more recently, in the United States, as well as other developing countries, obesity is starting to cause problems. As people become more heavy, they develop fatty infiltrate in their liver that leads to chronic inflammation and ultimately cirrhosis. In the United States, that's now becoming the most rapidly developing cause of liver cancer as we have better treatments to control hepatitis C and hepatitis B.
What are the symptoms if a patient has liver cancer, and how do you diagnose it?
Yeah, early on, there may not be a lot of symptoms. That often when people come in with liver cancer, it's because they have problems related to their liver function from their underlying cirrhosis. In that setting, usually you'll start to see people become progressively more tired, maybe start to develop fluid in their abdomen that causes some extension or bloating of their abdomen. People may start to notice that they're losing some muscle mass as their liver isn't performing the functions that it needs to do.
But the liver has a lot of excess capacity,
it
right?
It does. And so certainly in a younger person with even cirrhosis, or a healthy older person with cirrhosis, they may not be aware of it early on. And that's certainly one of the concerns. If somebody has underlying hepatitis C that can be a very chronic disease, they may go on for years not realizing they have the infection, let alone or developing progressive cirrhosis. And then on top of that, start to develop a small cancer that really has no symptoms unless it starts to block up the drainage of bile out of the liver, or it spreads to some other part of the body where it's starting to cause some problems.
And how do you confirm the diagnosis?
There are several ways to do that. With modern radiologic techniques, with the different scans that we have, there are ways to identify an abnormality in the liver, and using an MRI or a CT scan, we can begin to define whether something looks like a cancer or a non-cancerous process within the liver, such as a cyst or some other benign change. But with the way the tumor takes up the contrast that's given intravenously to highlight abnormalities in the liver, it can show that something is much more likely to be a cancer. In addition to that, with some causes of liver cancer like hepatitis B, there's much more likely to be an elevated marker in the blood called alpha-fetoprotein that can go up and be easy indicator that something's going on in the liver that may represent liver cancer.
And confirm it with a biopsy.
In some cases, yes, it requires a biopsy. In other cases, the imaging with a scan as well as a blood test may be enough to confirm that indeed it is liver cancer and you don't need to do a biopsy in that setting.
So what are the treatment options?
When a liver cancer is caught early, before it becomes large or starts to spread elsewhere, there are a lot of potential approaches. If a person's liver is working very well, it's possible in some cases to go in and surgically remove the cancer. In other cases, if a person's liver isn't working well enough where surgery would be safe, or the tumor's in a part of the liver that would just be difficult to remove, there are ways to stick a needle into the tumor and heat it up, what's called ablation, to be able to burn it out or freeze it. If the tumor starts to spread through different parts of the liver, there are ways that we can infuse something directly into the liver, be that chemotherapy or a radioactive substance, to try to kill a lot of the cancer. And for people who might be a candidate, there's strict criteria. In some cases, if a person has underlying liver disease that's becoming quite severe and a small amount of cancer there, they may be a candidate for a liver transplant.
So tell us about the new drug you've got.
For the people where the cancer is spread beyond the ability to do something directly to the liver, that it's spread outside the liver, or that just isn't possible to do anything directly to the liver, there are now several different approaches with drug therapy. For the last 10, 15 years, we've had a drug called sorafenib. It's a non-chemotherapy drug that works to help treat the cancer and usually keeps it stable. But more recently, a new drug came along in 2017 called regorafenib. They have these wonderful names.
Regorafenib.
Yes. And regorafenib, like sorafenib, is not a chemotherapy drug, but does things to shut off some of the genes that cause the cancer to grow and restrict some of its blood flow. Those two drugs have helped to control liver cancer and its growth, extending the time that we can keep it under control and hopefully allow newer, better options to come along. There are several new things coming forward. The FDA approved a form of immunotherapy with a drug called nivolumab, based on some early information to show that in about 25% of people, this type of immunotherapy also works in liver cancer, irregardless of the cause of the liver cancer.
What's new in liver cancer research?
Right now, there are a lot of new drugs coming along. They're focused, again, on gene or molecular changes that are important in liver cancer that are showing promise, either used in combination with immunotherapy or separate from that. So a lot of things that look hopeful on the horizon, and certainly a lot better than we were just a couple of years ago.
All right, some good news on liver cancer with Dr. Steve Alberts. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Alberts is a division chair of medical oncology at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, our colleague, Dr. Sanj Kakkar, joins me as co-host, and we'll learn how behavioral interventions can be helpful to treat insomnia. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Sanj Kakkar.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
You've probably experienced it, feeling so tired you can barely function at work or school because you didn't get enough sleep. Insomnia is a common sleep disorder that can make it hard to fall asleep, hard to stay asleep, or cause you to wake up too early and not get back to sleep.
In fact, insomnia is perhaps the second most common health complaint after pain. It's estimated that 15 to 30% of adults suffer from insomnia. So how can you improve your chances of getting that good night's sleep? Here to discuss treatment for insomnia is Mayo Clinic psychologist, Dr. Craig Sawchuk. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Sawchuk. It's good to see you.
Great. Thank you for having me back.
First of all, I thought that insomnia, we would have one of our sleep experts, not the psych guy. How is insomnia a psychological problem?
Well, I tell you, the behavioral psychologists have had insomnia figured out in terms of a very effective treatment for it for several decades. It's actually only been until more recently that the American College of Physicians identified cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia as the first line treatment for insomnia disorder and insomnia-related problems. And that's actually a big deal coming from a physician group where traditionally sleeping medications are unbelievably frequently prescribed and have short-term effectiveness at best.
So Dr. Sawchuk, many people vary in how much sleep they need. So how do you define insomnia?
Yeah, insomnia is not really based upon, well, how much sleep did you actually get? You know, it's not about sleep quantity, it's more like quality. So when we drill down to exactly what is insomnia, it's 3 days out of a given week over the course of 3 months that you have some problem with either sleep initiation, so the classic sleep onset, I'm laying in bed trying to fall asleep and I can't sleep, or that fragmented shallow sleep during the night, waking up a lot during the night and then having difficulties falling back asleep, or early awakening. So it's any one of those three that in turn leads to the non-restorative sleep and in turn can cause some problems in day-to-day functioning.
So what are the risk factors for insomnia? So for example, many people look at their emails before they go to bed or watch TV. Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing?
It's a bad thing. And good thing Dr. Shives isn't here today. He gets a little upset about the use of electronics and iPhones. But it's true. You know, the reality is that the vast majority of people have absolutely horrible sleep habits, hygiene habits. They'll watch TV in bed. They'll eat in bed. They'll hang out in their bedroom, you know, just to rest. Or if they wake up in the middle of the night, they may just keep laying in bed, you know, awake. But those people don't necessarily go on to develop an insomnia problem. It's the people that have true clinical insomnia that we actually have to look beyond just the sleep hygiene related issues. They're still important to have in place, but there's some much more important components to treatment than just sleep hygiene.
I love the phrase sleep hygiene. Can you expound a little bit on that and what it means if someone's hearing it for the first time?
Yeah, the classic thing, think about them like healthy sleep habits. And we hear about these things all the time. It's good to be in a dark, quiet, cool room, reducing electronics and ambient light, trying to maintain a good sleep routine, avoiding excess caffeine in the afternoons, avoiding too much physical exercise before you go to bed. So those are some really classic basic adjustments that people can do that can be helpful in setting a good foundation. And again, for people without true insomnia problems, you do those things, their sleep improves. For people with insomnia, it's good to have those in place, but you don't want to just leave all your time with doing sleep hygiene things.
So you alluded upon it. Are there different types of insomnia then?
It can come out in different ways, but more often than not, you get people that have all the above problems. So the difficulties with sleep initiation, fragmented sleep, and early awakening. I think in the assessment of a person's sleep problems, it's always important to rule out some of the medical issues that could be driving this, like restless leg, sleep apnea. Mm-hmm. Sometimes medications to treat one condition can create some other problems. But really the issue from a behavioral standpoint is how does insomnia get maintained? So what happens is we go several nights without sleeping. Well, what do? We start to crank up our caffeine, you know, during the day. We start to go to bed at different times to try to get our sleep. Or we wake up in the middle of the night and we watch TV to try to bore our brain to fall back asleep. So the irony is that efforts that we make to try to manage that daytime fatigue, or when we wake up in the middle of the night to try to get ourselves back to sleep or to try to keep going, you know, throughout the day, actually very quickly become part of this conditioned problem over time.
I was going to ask you about shift workers. How does this affect shift workers?
Yeah, this is an unfair situation, but this is, you know, very much one of these cultural environmental factors that can make trying to get into a biorhythm of sleep and a sleep habit more challenging. It's not impossible. We work actually with a number of shift workers, especially nurses in our primary care clinics all the time with working on insomnia, but it makes it harder because any machine, any biorhythm works better when you have consistency.
What's the difference between primary and secondary insomnia?
Yeah, primary insomnia can be coming from some kind of medical condition. Secondary insomnia can be that learned pattern that happens over time. People can benefit from behavioral strategies in either case.
And I also see the phrase transient versus chronic insomnia. Is that kind of the same thing?
It's a time series, so I would say transient can be within that 3-month time window, or certain times of the year they may be more vulnerable to insomnia than others, whereas the chronic insomnia usually doesn't matter the time of year that they go through. It's just a persistent problem.
Is there a typical patient who suffers from insomnia?
It is so equal opportunity. Just usually, like, sleep needs change, you know, as time goes along and our patterns do change. But it really is an equal opportunity type of condition that can affect anybody at any time. But almost regardless of where the insomnia comes from, it doesn't matter. It's how insomnia is being maintained. And that's how behavioral therapy can be effective in managing that.
Let's talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah. Two parts of a behavioral intervention that are extremely important. So we already talked about getting the good sleep habits, you know, under control. There's behavioral principle called stimulus control. It's a very clunky behavioral term, but essentially it means reassociating the bed in the nighttime with sleep. And there's a number of different factors that actually go into that. So first off is developing a nighttime routine. So maybe a half hour, an hour before you go to bed, you start to reduce stimulation. You get the lights low, turn off the screens, turn off the TV, brush your teeth, get uncomfortable clothes, and get into bed. This is not unlike how we teach our kids to fall asleep. This provides the brain with signs that sleep is coming. So doing that washout period is step number one.
And really, it's not just for kids.
Not just for kids. It's for adults. We can't escape our basic biology.
Right. Very good.
Secondly, is that once we're in bed, hopefully we fall asleep, but if we're in bed longer than 15 or 20 minutes, we actually want to get up and get out of bed. So we're trying to reduce the amount of wakeful time spent in bed. Sometimes people are given horrible advice. Hey, if you're in bed and you're not sleeping, at least you're resting. No, what you're doing is you're conditioning the brain to look at the bed in the nighttime with being awake. So what we actually get people to do is actually get out of their bed, go into another room, keeping it dark, keeping it quiet.
No TV.
Be in a sitting up position and do boring things. Like read something very familiar to you, listening to really light music, doing relaxation. And then when you start to feel sleepy, so your eyes get heavy, your head starts to bob a little bit, those are cues to get back into bed. Don't go back to bed when you're tired. Go back to bed when you're sleepy. And then if you fall asleep once you get back into bed, that's great. If you wake up again, keep repeating that cycle. And then one of the other things that we do as part of the stimulus control is reduce any wakeful activities in your bedroom during the normal wakeful day. So when your alarm goes off in the morning, get up, you know, get changed and get out of the bedroom. Try to reduce hanging out in your bedroom, watching TV, eating, hanging out with the kids. It's kind of like getting out of the dorm room effect of our bed, is we don't want that to be Grand Central Station.
What about melatonin or other medications?
Well, if we think of prescribed medications, which has been the default treatment that's been done in primary care, they're only meant for short-term use, anywhere between 4 to 5, maybe in upwards of 6 weeks. However, the vast majority of folks that are on these medications use them for much longer. And we know clinically that they contribute to sleep problems actually as time goes along and lower quality of sleep. Melatonin has actually quite mixed results. It tends not to be harmful, but it also is not nearly as helpful as we'd like to think.
We've been talking about behavioral interventions to help treat insomnia with Mayo Clinic psychologist Dr. Craig Sawchuk. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Sawchuk.
Great. Thank you for having me.
And that's our program for this week.
You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our producer for the program is Jennifer O'Hara. For Mayo Clinic Radio, I'm Dr. Sanj Kakkar.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Thanks for joining us.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.